welcome to the History of Education Society podcast. Every month we'll be featuring interviews, ideas, thought-provoking discussions, collaborations and publications from across the field of the history of education and beyond. Today I'm joined by Carmen Fleury and Rosalie Aguero from the University of Zurich, who are researchers on the Education and the European Digital Agenda Project, to talk about their work in this area, which is really exciting. So thank you both for joining. The history of computer education and this idea of the history of the digital agenda is really interesting, but certainly speaking for myself, it's something I really don't know very much about. So I wondered if we could start by talking a bit about both of your backgrounds and your research interests, because I'm really interested to see how you both came to work on this topic.
Well, I did my master's in history of education and economic history, and now I'm a PhD in the Digital Agenda Project. And well, basically the starting point of our project is that all these technological issues about computer education are enjoying a boom currently, and even more so now due to Corona. And historical perspectives, however, are still missing. So instead of doing research on these education technologies, we thought that it would be appropriate to talk about these new problems within their historical conditions. So basically tell the story of how we came to where we are now with these technologies, especially in education. So my own PhD project is concerned with computer education in the German Democratic Republic. We're actually comparing Germany, Switzerland, and Sweden. And in my case study, I'm particularly interested how certain technological imaginaries guided the implementation of computer education under the authoritarian socialist government. And computer education was seen as a promising means to advance socialism and actually catch up with Western capitalist countries in terms of economic competitiveness and productivity. And for that reason, every worker would need to be educated and trained and using computers to reach that goal. So I am interested in how exactly these ideas played out in the design of a computer education curriculum for all.
From the history side myself, I have a PhD in economic history from Uppsala University in Sweden, and I have mainly worked with gender history and audiovisual media. My PhD thesis was a comparative study between Mexico and Sweden on how the relationship between paid work and romantic love was represented in films from the 1930s to the 1950s. From there, I realized that technology was a major topic in cultural studies. Films tended to show plenty of office environments, for example, as well as domestic environments full of domestic appliances, typewriters, vacuum cleaners, and other cultural objects were symbols that talked a lot about the kind of person or the kind of society the film was describing, but also about the gender structures in place in that society. I then became very interested in technology and then computers as cultural objects. And I have been particularly interested in the gender perspective. So I came to a project on the history of digital education in Europe with that background. And I am now interested in the role of women in computer education and how computer education has approached women. I study Sweden in particular, but I'm interested also in the European developments.
Great. Thank you both. That's really loads of interesting stuff to kind of get into there. So I thought before we started, perhaps we could define a little bit what we mean by computer education, because I'm sure that maybe that term or the term kind of digital agenda kind of really covers a lot of things. So I wondered how you would define both of those things.
Right. So with digital agenda, we generally refer to government issued initiatives. So we want to say it's kind of like a state agenda behind it. There are a lot of actors and stakeholders involved, so we chose to mainly focus on government-issued initiatives. But when we talk about computers in education, of course, we refer to a wide area of how computers were used to modernize the educational system or provide learners with new knowledge and skills, to cope with this new reality in which computers grew more and more important in vast areas of society and the economy. So I think we can distinguish three main areas of computers in education, of which the first is learning about computers. So in which computers are the subject of teaching and learning, such as programming instruction or learning about how computers function and how they can be used to solve problems. And the second area would be learning with computers, in which computers serve as a means of instruction, as a tool, really, in the hands of teachers and learners, which can be used in various school subjects and disciplines for experiments, the modeling and visualization of processes in physics, chemistry, or biology, and as an instrument for data and text processing in maths and languages. And the third area is really outside of the scope of computer education, because this refers to computer use in school administration, that is for educational planning and organization.
Great. So I wondered what kind of context it was in which computer education emerged in kind of the mid to late 20th century. So what sorts of societal economic changes were taking place, and what sorts of issues were driving the emergence of computer education?
Yeah, for us, the context is actually really important, because a lot of things were happening in this period on different fronts. For example, in the 1960s, education started to be regarded as an essential tool for achieving competitiveness and economic growth. The 60s marked the start of the European and Western cooperation in education. For example, the OECD starts talking about this cooperation and creating these programs, which were really important to create economic growth. And it came an understanding that economic growth depended on the supply of trained engineers, scientists, and technicians. We also have to see this period as a part of the Cold War context. So the West is trying to win the tech race with the Eastern Bloc, and that should be part of it. On the technology side, we look at the time in which mainframe computer producers in Europe are behind the US, and there is this concern about how to step up and really find, because they were like about 5 to 6 years behind in Europe. So many national and supranational agencies granted support to companies and then also universities and research centers to solve this issue. In the 1970s, we see the shift from mainframe computers, which were used in universities and industry for electronic data processing, to personal computers and home computers with the introduction of the microchip. Computers became smaller and more affordable, and their use became increasingly common in many jobs and in private homes. The 1980s marked the intervention of the European communities to create the infrastructure that was needed in Europe to step up in this technology race. So there were lots of infrastructure projects, information projects that were supported up to the 1990s. And up to then, the EC programs emphasized European competitiveness and information markets, but later also economic development and social cohesion. The digital agenda concept was being defined with ideas of internet access, digital literacy, and universal access to computer technology. There was a constant tension between economic on the one hand and social priorities on the other hand. So education was the area that was that served the purpose of reconciling both areas. So both economic and social priorities would be solved through education. Socially, this was also a time of increasing fears of unemployment, and there were lots of expectations about the computers. For example, many people thought that computers would make them lose their jobs or put especially vulnerable groups at risk, such as women or people with short education and so on. So we see a number of concerns and also a very specific social, political, and economic context that is really important to take into account.
So I know you both work on different national contexts, on East Germany and on Sweden. So I thought maybe we could talk about both of those contexts. And I wondered how computers and computer education were introduced in both of those national contexts and how that might have differed.
Well, we can see that in most countries early on, there were initiatives by often a few teachers who were just very enthusiastic about computers and had taught themselves how to use them. There was no teacher training really how to use a computer, so they were just autodidactics. And if they had managed to acquire a computer somehow for their own use, they would use it to teach talented and interested students in their free time, or even launch a small computer club. That was, although in East Germany, hard to come by a computer. Sometimes there was a chance to get one from a company or maybe from as an import from the West. A broader effort by the government to implement computer education on a large scale came relatively late in East Germany. That was in November 1985, when the Socialist Party leadership drew the consequences of technological progress in microelectronics for the educational system and decided on the introduction of computers into vocational training and education, higher education, but also general education. And well, the main premise was that an educational response had to be dedicated to the ideology of socialist society and the so-called all-round development of the socialist personality, whatever that meant. That was left to the teachers to figure out. And it was quite important for them to make a distinction from the approaches from capitalist countries. Thus, from an ideological viewpoint, it was not the technology itself that was problematic. After all, they did import and copy Western technology whenever they had the chance to. It was rather the way it was used that was ideologically charged in their perception. And that was, of course, at the heart of the efforts to teach all pupils about computers. What were people supposed to do with them? How were they to be used to advance socialism exactly? So socialist leadership put a strong emphasis on a scientific pedagogical approach rather than what allegedly the capitalist countries were doing, which was to leave computerization of education to the computer industry. That was perhaps the most pronounced contrast, the centralized planning in East Germany, while, for example, in West Germany, the state relied heavily on private initiatives and development of commercial computer software and hardware to equip schools. And then also we had, of course, the economy of scarcity. So there was a problem of equipping all schools with computers. And in East Germany, it was really a step-by-step approach in which special schools for gifted students and upper secondary schools were prioritized. And there weren't really that many home computers, so that was also why they weren't called home computers in the GDR, but rather microcomputers, as they were simply not available in large enough numbers or just too expensive for private use. So the state did actually develop a specialized school computer for the use in general and vocational education, but that only went into mass production in 1989, and merely some 5,000 computers were produced until the collapse of the GDR. There was actually also a system of informal computer education, which was quite important, especially because not all schools could be equipped. In schools, often computer education was taught using the blackboard and chalk and not really having any computers to use. So there were computer clubs, which consisted of computer hobbyists and tinkerers who mainly built their own simple computers by using the electronic parts that were available and programmed their own software, which was then often also distributed between teachers to use it in teaching. We have to keep in mind that the self-guided learning and self-taught use of computers was encouraged on the one hand by state officials, but on the other, also closely monitored and controlled. So by providing the infrastructure, computer magazines and manuals for these computer clubs, the Ministry of Education tried to exert at least some kind of influence on the purposes for which young people use the computers in their free time and to ensure that they were in line with the goals of the socialist regime.
Well, in the case of Sweden, we see some similarities, but also some differences, because Sweden was not one of the, you know, this, it has a market economy, but it was not the same path as other, the rest of the capitalistic Western European countries. So we see some similarities, but also they follow their own path. And well, one important difference is that contrary to the case that Cameron's explaining now, Sweden started quite early. So already in the 60s, there were state investigations about how to use computers in schools. And there were two purposes in the use of computers in schools, according to these investigations. On the one hand, there was an explicit interest to promote a democratic society through education. The idea was that the citizen should have knowledge to influence technology and make decisions on how technology should be used. On the other hand, there was an interest in fostering industrial development. So helping companies to succeed in developing technology for schools was also an industrial objective. In the late 70s and 80s, these purposes were embodied in the discussion of the computers to be used in schools. There were Swedish manufactured computers throughout the late 70s and 80s. And one interesting example of one of these computers was a Pioneer called the ABC-80. This was the first Swedish manufactured personal computer. And this had an important role in education because it was the first one to be used in teaching in different subjects to make calculations and so on. So it was not used in all the subjects, but for example, in physics and mathematics was very common. Not very common, but it was used. This computer reached the market in 1978, and it had, of course, successors throughout the years. But something important happened in 1982, and that was that that computer education became mandatory in the new curriculum introduced that year. So that was 1982. But 1 year earlier, there was a decision made by the government to set up a procurement project for a school computer. And this means that a group formed by different relevant authorities and experts would come up with the specification for a standardized school computer. So the idea was that different companies would create a prototype, and the best prototype would receive a lot of financial support from the government. And long story short, the Compiz computer was created. So this computer was the one that was used mainly in schools, and the government invested a large sum to promote not only the computer that would be the best for schools, but a lot of money to foster technical development among the Swedish computer industry. The latter purpose was somehow attained because a lot of know-how was created. So all these companies created different computers with different specifications, like trying to really get to the top to win the bid. So many of the people working in this prototype ended up working in IBM or other companies when the national computer companies disappeared. So it was somehow successful, but the computer itself was never regarded as a success. In 1985, which was the year in which it was used, it started trial periods before that in 84. But in 1985, 60% of the school market had the Compiz computer. And it was not the best computer in the market, I have to say, but it was cheap. And that was really important because that is one of the main reasons why a school might decide to buy one computer over the other. The thing is that in 86 and 87, the computer prices fell. So all the computers that were actually better got cheaper, and there was no reason why a school would choose a campus computer anymore. So in 1988, the production was discontinued. So this is an interesting story of, you know, the whole effort by the government to create a computer to enter the schools and to also boost the industry, the Swedish industry. Another important part of the puzzle that also Carmen mentioned was the teachers. The teachers were key players in the computerization of Swedish schools. And just as in many other countries, and as it happened, at the beginning, it was mainly a few enthusiastic teachers that introduced computer in their schools. So, of course, we have from 1982 the need of schools to actually have people trained in computer education so that they could teach the pupils, because they needed to fulfill this requirement. But that was not necessarily the case. There were many teachers that were against this decision. Some of the teachers, they recall, for example, the humanities teacher as being against the introduction of computers, or the fact that they needed to learn about computers themselves. And of course, it wasn't mandatory for all teachers to learn about computers. So it was only those who were interested that could take courses. And there was always some physics teacher or maths teacher who would take the courses. At the beginning, as Carmen also mentioned, they were self-taught. But soon, like in the mid-80s, there were already many courses in place in the teacher colleges, at the universities, and also some companies offered courses. For example, computer companies or hardware companies, and teaching materials companies who made software for these computers. So many people attended these courses, and that's how they all started. But there is also this other side of computer education outside of school. And when it comes to computer literacy, the Swedish state created the Broad Computer Education Project, and this was meant to teach the society about computers, those who were not in the schooling system anymore. And the assumption was that all citizens had the right to information and knowledge about the possibilities and risks of the information society. This initiative emphasized the role of education for the development and use of computer technology under democratic rule. Women and the short educated were identified as the group with the greatest need for computer education. So within the framework of this program, the state sponsored a lot of activities. They gave money to study associations or organizations of different kinds, like youth organizations, children's organizations, women's organizations, and they were the ones creating the material and the content and so on. So the interesting thing is that it was, again, a state-sponsored project. So it was not, as in other places, just the civil society trying to fill a gap, but the state itself filling a gap with the help of all these other organizations that were interested in contributing to teaching computers to groups who were not in the school system.
I think it's fascinating to see kind of the interconnections between kind of the government and the state, but also industry and society, and the way those different actors all played a role in the development of computer education. I was wondering what sorts of issues arose from the development of computer education. So what sort of impact this had on different groups? I know you spoke briefly about the impact on women in particular. Could you talk a bit more about the sorts of things that developed from the introduction of computers and computer education into schools and beyond?
Yeah, I could go a bit deeper into the effect of computerization on women. Women were, as I said, regarded as particularly affected by computerization, because many of the female-dominated jobs were expected to disappear, and many jobs would also be reorganized in a way that women's expertise would no longer be needed. So in Sweden, there was a discussion, for example, about the word processing centers. So there was this thought that the future of women's work would lead to these sort of places, like centralized places where, instead of manufacturing a garment as it was before, they would be creating some kind of technological or some kind of digital product. So this could happen in different ways, either fitting a computer centrals at home, like in the homes of women, or creating some kind of neighborhood center where women could go there and work. Many women's organizations were against this idea because this could lead to the isolation of women and the loss of influence over the work tasks. So this idea, which actually happened in other places, was fought against and finally dismissed in Sweden. In Europe, what we can see is a clear development when we observe the programs that targeted women's education in computers. All of these programs more or less aimed at giving women basic computer education so that they could easily find a job in the new technology society. But the idea was that they would do the low qualified office jobs. They would have then a job guaranteed, but this would be one without promotion possibilities and low paid. So this was the case for most of the period we're talking about. Only in the 1990s, there was a discussion about bringing women to the high-skilled tech jobs, and that was it. There was a discussion, but there was still not much funding to achieve this aim. In Sweden, I have been studying the role of a women's organization that was very active in promoting women's education in technology. It's called the Fredrika Bremer Association. And what makes this organization and the Swedish case interesting is the fact that although women's unemployment was an issue they were worried about, the main purpose was to encourage women to participate in the creation of technology and in the decision making about technology, about the technology society, and in this highly skilled tech jobs. So contrary to what was the development in Europe, which was something that they were seeing, they wanted to, on the other hand, promote the participation of women in the higher ranks of technology through education. So they worked a lot with non-formal education. They organized a variety of activities to educate the general public, teachers, career counselors, etc., in the importance of bringing women to high-level technical education and research. They worked a lot with role models, for example. So they would interview women who were in very high positions, and they would take them to school. They would interview them and publish their interviews in the press, in their own journals, and in different media. They also promoted computer courses and computer workshops. They had exhibitions, talks, seminars, conferences, and they tried to bring together different actors in society. So the message that they wanted to spread through different media was, on an ideological level, the message was that technology would be better and more humane and if women were present, if women participated, and it would then be more useful for society. Women were as skillful and capable as men to deal with technology, and they had other abilities. They could see the full picture, whereas men could only, or they saw the technology as a something in itself that was interesting in itself. Women could put the technology in context and see how it could contribute to the improvement of society or something like that. Then, in order to fight extremely gender segregated labor market, which was something that was very highly debated in Sweden, to deal with this problem, women needed to be in the technical area, in education, research, and industry. We could say that they partly succeeded. They could see some increases in the number of women following technical educational tracks when they could measure it. They presented the results and the numbers were higher, especially in the places where they put some inputs. But the gender segregation is still there even today. So, I mean, it was not a full success, but there was some success. But perhaps the most important contribution of these organizations with all these activities was that they put the topic in the public debate. And it was discussed, and I mean, we cannot say that the government followed their advice necessarily, but they were very active in bringing that advice to the government and commenting on all the different laws and state investigations and so on. So they really wanted to contribute in the political arena. So this is one example of surely many in which the civil society and groups outside of the educational system are important in contributing to computer literacy and a different approach to technology in society.
Yeah, that was a bit different, I think, in East Germany. At least on a discursive level, you didn't have the stark gender segregation of the labor market, and it was actually also in reality much more equal. But there was still the need to bring more women into computer jobs just because there was a lack of skilled people. And there was also this kind of vertical segregation of jobs. So the higher up jobs, there were actually mainly males, while on the very simple data input jobs where you would just sit on a computer and type in data were often done by women, in fact. What was maybe the big difference between a socialist country like the GDR as to Sweden was that there wasn't this fear of losing your job. What drove further education in computer and computer education in many of the capitalist countries was this fear of, if I don't learn how to use a computer, I will be out of my job, or I won't find a career anymore. And that was different in East Germany because there was a guaranteed right to a job. If I lost my job, the state would just provide me with a new one. So they actually had a problem to motivate people to undergo further training on how to use a computer or automate a machine in the workplace. And they had to launch, well, strongly ideologically call it campaigns to motivate people and show them the benefits of computers and how it would make the work more interesting and, of course, advance society for the good of everyone. So basically, undergoing computer training was your part in doing good for everyone and a socialist society, and not so much out of fear for losing your own job.
It's really interesting to hear you both talk about those two different national contexts. And I know your project is specifically focused on Switzerland, Sweden, and Germany after 1970. So I wondered if you thought there are any particular benefits or if you can gain anything from taking a sort of comparative or transnational approach to consider the emergence of this kind of digital society.
I mean, what we can see is that computer education was a key concern for all industrialized nation states in the 1980s. As they were faced with similar challenges pertaining to technology and the new social developments. However, we can see that each country set their own priorities in who should be educated in what area. And yeah, in general, what a computer education would entail with regard to the specific sociocultural ideas of computerization and what it meant for their economy and society. So therefore, a history of computer education should consider, on the one hand, these transnational aspects of developments, such as transnational cooperation, the exchange of ideas and technological developments, but also consider the national and local context through case studies to highlight how different policies and initiatives regarding the introduction of computers into education took place, and what actors were involved and what kind of issues and opportunities were identified by them. And as we can see from the cases of Switzerland, Sweden, and the two Germanies, the social, political, and economic circumstances and preconditions varied quite a bit between these states and led to different paths of bringing computers into education.
So thank you both so much. It's been really great to learn more about this area, which is something I didn't know a huge amount about before. I guess to end, I wondered if there were any interesting further areas for research that both of you were kind of particularly excited about, or if you could talk about sort of what's next for you both in your research and some particular areas that you're looking to pursue.
Well, yeah, there is still plenty to do in this area. One thing we would like to see is work at a more global level. Of course, we do now Europe, but there is much more than Europe, right? So we have histories of other places of the world, like Asia or Latin America, etc. And we're actually planning to do something like that at the end of our project. We would like to invite researchers from places outside of Europe to have some kind of workshop and then organize a volume on that, because it's so interesting to see what happens. Like, sometimes we tend to be so Euro-centered, and there's more to it. There's other specific topics as well that we consider would be interesting to approach, like the role of large transnational organizations to modernize education in the so-called developing countries, or also in other countries, by promoting the use of computers in education. The efforts of other states to build up their own computer industries and implement their own concepts of computer education, for example. Then there's other areas of computer education outside of school, like informal computer education, the hacker culture, home computing, computer labs, young programmers, etc. So there is a lot to discuss. Different groups, how different groups have approached computer education. What actors have we been missing? So now, for example, I'm talking about women's organizations, but there's surely plenty more that we haven't even thought about. There's countries that we don't know anything about in terms of how they have developed their user culture, for example. So these are just a few examples.
Yeah, I hope we can spark some interest among other researchers maybe to dive into their own national histories of technology education, because there's so much more to be done on this topic of how computers actually entered education, on perspective of students and teachers and producers of learning materials. And yeah, we really hope others will join us on this journey.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you both so much. It's a fascinating topic, and I really do think people will come away from this with a renewed interest and perhaps be inspired to go away and look into this in their own context. So yeah, thank you both so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.